very pleasing to God. And we thank Allah for the opportunity to share a few moments with our noted leader, the Honorable Imam Waterfuddin Muhammad. He is the guest of the Sister Clara Muhammad School. On this weekend, we enjoyed a very wonderful evening at the Hilton Hotel on yesterday evening. And we would like to greet you, Imam Waterfuddin Muhammad. Thank you for joining us.
As-salamu thank you. Wa alaikum as-salam.
What I'd like to do before opening any lines, we're going to have a little conversation with Imam Muhammad, and we'd like to take off on discussing the evening of elegance. Not to get, not necessarily discussing it, but just getting some feedback on how you felt about that experience last night, Imam Muhammad.
We look forward each year to joining you in Oakland, the mosque here, Masjid Waterfuddin, for the Clara Muhammad School Evening of Elegance. And each time that I have attended the Evening of Elegance, I have gotten more than I expected. And I always look forward with great enthusiasm. I look forward for the next Evening of Elegance.
Thank you very much. We like to, let's begin looking at this weekend is saturated with the thoughts of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement. I'd like to begin our dialogue along those lines. When you look at the Civil Rights Movement, Muhammad, just by and large, what do you think brought it about, and what do you think was the primary motivation for the Civil Rights Movement?
The freedom struggle itself, beginning even during the time of slavery, as we know that there were revolts, there were resistance by black slaves, even during the days of slavery, Nat Turner and a few others. The civil rights movement was a continuation of that struggle, but within the law, within the law, the Constitution of the United States. What brought it about was the denial of humanity to our lot at that time, which was a lot of slaves.
When we look at slavery, we understand that, well, from my own reading, that racism is an ideology that basically came up sort of to rationalize slavery. Some of the thinking that slavery itself was not generated from a hatred of white poor black, but from an economic position or from a situation that they find themselves in, but then with the onslaught of those abolitionists or abolitionists like the Quakers and what have you, then the other side began to develop a racist ideology in order to support slavery. What kind of thinking is it that caused individuals to demean a human being in the manner that blacks were demeaned or African Americans were demeaned in the slavery tradition?
I think there's a lot to be said on that, but we have to remember that from the very beginning of our captivity in America, in the South, mainly in the South, there was a justification, pretended justification for our enslavement. And those slave traders, and they got support from, I think just greedy people for material gain from slavery. They got support from people, even in church life, for a belief that they were doing us a favor by bringing the heathen from Africa and giving him an opportunity to serve slave masters of democracy and of Christian society.
Yeah, that was a big debate. There's an author, his name is Hasselman, and he talks about the Christian roots of racism, and he's a Baptist preacher. One thing he said that the white church is the mother of the black church, that is, racism is the mother of the black church, because there was no need for a black church had they been allowed to integrate in worship with the other fellow Christians. Other authors have said also that they felt like it was better to be a slave Christian than to be a free heathen, just in supporting what you have just said. Let's move up to the 20th century. At the turn of the century, we saw figures like Noble Drew Ali, we saw figures like Marcus Garvey, And in that genre of leadership, what do you think that those kind of leaders meant for us at the turn of the century, beginning or keeping with the freedom struggle for African Americans? What did those kind of leaders mean to us?
It appears that two major influences were responsible for the type of leaders, the two types of leaders we got then and even now. I believe the influence was the courage in us to take as much of the blame and as much of the responsibility for our state of affairs as possible upon ourselves. We've had some really courageous men in that respect. And Marcus Garvey and a few others that I could name, but I don't care to name right now, were outstanding. And on the other side, we had those men who were strongly moved to address the false ideas and false beliefs of the oppressing of the oppressors, of the oppressors, those people who were justifying slavery and Jim Crow and discrimination in the last years of that page of horror, page of ugliness on America. They were strongly moved to convince by argument, and the civil rights movement, as you know, used legal argument. To convince by argument that those persons who believe in the racism or in the inferiority of blacks or justification for oppressing blacks, that they were wrong. They wanted to convince them by argument that they were wrong, and that it wasn't healthy for them, and at the same time it was inhuman to us.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so those are the two groups and the forces. I hope I have. Pointed to those influences as one, urging the person to take upon himself responsibility for his state of affairs, and the other influence is the influence to answer the critics, to answer the abusers of our people, and hope that we will change their ideas, change their minds, you know. So these are the two major movements that have produced the two major divisions we see in our leadership today. And I would like to mention, since we are observing tomorrow Dr. King's day, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s day, that though we had those divisions, there was always a great respect for real established leadership in the civil rights movement coming from our side.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I was, as you know, and you were too, a separatist.
Mm-hmm.
Or believe in separation.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the civil rights movement, along with the majority of our people, were believers in integration. And those terms don't really clearly define what two were all about, I don't
mm-hmm.
think,
mm-hmm.
you know. But it so happened that that was the mood, to integrate on one side and to preach self-support and separation on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
The Honorable Elijah Muhammad appeared to be just totally unwilling to compromise or to even see good in the other side.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way he appeared.
Mm-hmm.
But I know for a fact, as you do,
mm-hmm.
that he met with Dr. King, and they had great respect for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Great respect for each other. They had compliments and praise for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
I thought we should say that.
Certainly, that's very good. It points up a wonderful illustration that I've seen used for that particular problem. In fact, it's called the dilemma that we're in. A model is drawn of a solar system, the sun in the center, and a planet orbiting around the sun. And the author described the pulling effect as there's a the centripetal force, and then there's a pushing effect, the centrifugal force, But the planet remains in an orbit because it neither goes out nor does it come in.
Mm-hmm.
And many civil rights leaders or many black leaders have tried to resolve this dilemma by meeting either of those extremes. One saying, well, let's totally assimilate, let's totally integrate. Mm-hmm. And the other saying, well, let's totally separate, let's totally pull ourselves out of the system.
I like the way you put that illustration. It's very good. Yeah, we should be like that planet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's Islam. Wouldn't you? I'm sure you would. That's not an intelligent question. Islam is a reconciling force, though.
Yes,
Islam,
it is. Yes,
it allows that. How does Islam reconcile that particular dilemma?
Peace is the dominant idea in our religion. Peace. Mm-hmm. And peace requires that you reconcile if possible, that there be reconciliation if possible, but sometimes there cannot be reconciliation because there's an injustice that's required for that reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
And peace, true peace, doesn't make that kind of agreement, just or agree to that kind of reconciliation if it's not just. And our leaders on the civil rights side, they were advocating a just settlement,
mm-hmm.
a just settlement, you know. And I'm sure that many thought that the civil rights movement was a movement of troublemakers at one point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a movement of troublemakers. And they were charged with being troublemakers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. King came to Chicago. That's what he was charged with, even before he got into Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
That the troublemakers are coming. He was coming to a northern city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
yes, we are Muslims. We believe in peace. That's our spirit. That's our hope, is mainly for peace. But like the civil rights leaders that insisted upon a dignified settlement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We have situations that won't allow us to accept peace without dignity or without justice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, many people, in talking to those people that are trying to reconcile within their own selves the nature of this problem in order to live on into the 21st century, there seems to be a spirit of revenge that remains in a lot of African American people, thinking or feeling that the conditions that we suffered in slavery and pointing to that as the main source of our problem here now in 1980s feel like there must be their justice. When they say justice, they think about revenge or payback or retribution. Is there something wrong with that thinking? And if so, what is it?
Yes, the spirit of revenge is a counterproductive thing. And justice is different. Revenge is another thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. We should seek justice, not revenge,
mm-hmm.
Because actually a person who desires revenge can never be satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Everything is going to call for something else.
Yes.
Share some thoughts with us about your experiences with Malcolm Shabazz.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thought that comes to my mind is that he was very intelligent man, a very skillful debater, and a dedicated worker, a hard and dedicated worker, a great organizer, a man with great sharp perception.
Mm-hmm.
He could right away look at a situation as a minister responsible for certain matters, certain projects. He could look at the situation right away and perceive right away what should be done.
Mm-hmm.
He's a gifted person, that's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
I see him as a very intelligent and gifted person, and a man with a spirit just to accept the job and keep working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think that it should be noted for the audience. Most people are in this area, because of this program and other activities, are familiar with some of your history in the Nation of Islam and now as leader of the Muslim American community. And you were excommunicated on a couple of occasions from your father's community at that time. And was one of those situations because of a relationship or some accusations or allegations related to your influencing Malcolm Shabazz to his, quote, new way of thinking?
Yes, exactly. I was excommunicated more than once, more than twice, in fact, about three times. And the first time I was excommunicated, it was for, I was charged with disagreeing with basic theology of the then Nation of Islam,
mm-hmm.
the belief that the man that taught my father was God.
Mm-hmm.
I was charged with differing with that belief, and I was excommunicated, asked to leave the society, and not to have any association with any members of the society. That's the kind of excommunication it was,
mm-hmm.
you know. And not to contact my relatives,
mm-hmm.
my father and my mother,
mm-hmm.
his
mm-hmm.
sister,
mm-hmm.
and other relatives, who were Muslim. And I accepted that. I understood it. I knew the law of our organization.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the law, and I was prepared to accept that. So I accepted that. But one thing I was determined to do. And that was not to obey that law that I can't contact my father and my mother. So on special occasions, I would write them. I would stay in touch with my father. I would send him greetings, and he wouldn't answer. He obeyed the law, but I knew his heart was affected. I knew him. He's a good man.
Mm-hmm.
And he eventually, he would send for me.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't come back on my own. He would send for me. He sent for me the first time and asked to tell Wallace he can return.
Mm-hmm.
So I returned. And the second time, which happened about it was only a few months, maybe like two or three months later, I was charged with feeding the ideas to Malcolm.
Mm-hmm.
That I was feeding these ideas to Malcolm, and also giving support to certain other damaging kind of curiosities that Malcolm had
mm-hmm.
at that time, you know. So I was charged with that and excommunicated again. And I asked to face my accuser.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, can I face my accuser? I said, Malcolm has said, did Malcolm say I did this? So can I face Malcolm? No, you cannot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was excommunicated.
And that was it.
Yeah.
Your father was a very strong man. You know, in listening to what you said and in other lectures and really just reviewing the history, you know, there's something very, this is not a question, this is a statement for our audience. In terms of Abraham was in a very similar situation to the one that you seem to describe, well, your history kind of reflects to me.
Yeah, especially regarding the theology, I can see that, you know,
because mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
he had difficulty being peaceful with his father,
mm-hmm.
while his father was imposing upon him
mm-hmm.
a theology that he couldn't accept.
Mm-hmm. And on faith, he moved out on that anyway.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Tell us a little bit about your father. Maybe you can give us a little idea about how he was at home, you know, the
mm-hmm.
man, Elijah Muhammad.
Yes, again, like Malcolm, he was obviously a very gifted man
mm-hmm.
and a very intelligent man, though he differed from Malcolm in that Malcolm was a man that had a lot of formal education, and his background was such, his family background was such that he didn't suffer the neglect, the cultural neglect, that the degree of cultural neglect that my father suffered. Malcolm's mother was a very intelligent, educated woman, and his family spoke very good English, whereas my mother and father, my father didn't go to school except for 3 years, elementary school in the South, before coming to Detroit in the North. And my mother, she only was about to graduate from elementary school, but did not. She had close to 8 years of elementary schooling.
Mm-hmm.
So my home was typical of the ghetto home when it comes to being deprived of the opportunity to be educated.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to struggle for half of my life with just trying to correct the bad English. And even now it creeps in sometimes, you know, it's a habit.
But eloquence, in fact, I heard you describe eloquence one time, and you defined it as being able to say, get the most meaning in the fewest number of words, and I haven't found anybody at this time who's been able to do that as well as you have done.
Yes, but to finish, but making the point.
Mm-hmm.
However, my father had that avid thirst for knowledge and for improvement, all around improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So he studied, he read, he studied, he learned from his experiences, and over the years, his English improved so much. And the same for my whole household. My father and mother, they influenced the whole household. So all of my brothers and sisters, most of them are not educated, you know, but their language over the years improved. And now if you talk to any of them, you would think they graduated from junior college, at least.
That's right.
And just because of that determination in my father to improve, to learn, to correct himself. He knows, if he hear what someone else speak, and he realized that he was speaking wrong, his grammar was wrong, he would make an effort to correct himself. And he would read a lot. He would read other people's literature and knowledge, you know. He read other people's ideas, other people's books and other people's ideas. Although he knew he wasn't going to be changed, he knew his position wasn't going to be changed, but he just wanted to be informed. So a lot of our people have become great men, even great intellects, like the Honorable Elijah Muhammad did, just on self-determination and self-study, self-taught person.
Very good. We had the Evening of Elegance yesterday, and the Evening of Elegance is an annual benefit dinner for Sister Clara Muhammad Elementary and Secondary School, or as elementary school as it is in Oakland. Sister Clara Muhammad, in relationship to education, what kind of woman was she?
She was, first of all, a militant follower of her husband.
Mm.
She didn't compromise at all. Her children, she didn't accept that her children questioned her husband. Not any at all, you know. So she was his best, security guard. And she believed in him. She believed in what he taught. She believed in what he represented. She believed in him as a man. She believed in him, you know. And that was filtered. That came right down into us, into the children, all of us. We had, even though sometimes we would have serious disagreements, but we were afraid even to speak them in the privacy of our own mind, you know. we would be afraid to even think it, you know. Right away we'd be fighting our own thoughts, you know. That's the kind of respect my mother built up in us for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, my father. So her stand by the school and education was the same as his, you know. She accepted the same responsibility that was his, to see that this school gets whatever it needs, you know. So she would always have, with her little money, I remember the time we were poor. A lot of people probably think, you all were never poor. That's what you think. We were so poor, we borrowed chicken feet and saved and drank the broth and saved the feet to borrow it again. Get broth again. Yeah, it's a hard time. We had very, very hard times, and the whole community was very poor back then, and couldn't expect much from anybody. I'm talking about World War II times.
Yeah,
we're doing World War II.
When your father was incarcerated.
Exactly.
Your mother played a big role.
Yes, exactly. And at that during that time, she was there to support the whole organization, mainly the temple called Temple Inn, the temple and the later called Master Temple and the school. And at that time, we had no facility for the school. The children would be in some area of the temple, and that's where they would be taught, and there was no classrooms or anything, you know. You might be in several classes would be in the auditorium where the lecture was given, and maybe some special classes would have an office, you know. The older children would maybe have an office for their classroom. But I remember even before then, there was no classroom, no facility. And my mother taught us at home in the house. Mm-hmm. She would teach us in the house. And she would teach us to read. She would make sure we did our lessons. She would help us with our lessons. She'd teach us the arithmetic and everything. Mm-hmm. That continued to be her devotion until she passed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. She would come out at graduation time in the later years when we had a good facility and a good school.
Mm-hmm.
She would come out every graduation, and she would bring gifts to the graduates.
Mm-hmm.
And the same gleam that would be in her eye when her child achieved something,
mm-hmm.
I saw it in her eyes when other people's children
mm-hmm.
were being recognized for achieving that.
Mm-hmm.
That same gleam,
mm-hmm.
exactly. And she would give out roses to the girls sometimes, and other gifts to the boys.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. That's so beautiful. So I can see in your parents a great respect for knowledge.
Yes.
And education. I mean, they.
Oh yes.
You know. Even
and that's the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
That's the African American tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Writers have written that when Emancipation Proclamation came.
Mm-hmm.
And the slaves heard of it. Soon after, they say you could see the slave doing break time, resting on his plow.
Mm-hmm.
Women and men
mm-hmm.
reading something.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't care what it was. They just wanted to read something because they were deprived of the opportunity to learn or to study or to read anything before.
Mm-hmm.
So when freedom came, it was really noticeable that these slaves would doing break time, but instead of eating, they would be leaning on the plow. Leaning against something, reading a piece mm-hmm. of material, some page of material or something.
Mm-hmm.
This is KDIA, Oakland, San Francisco, San Jose.
Well, brothers and sisters, we've been talking with Imam Waterfedin Muhammad on very interesting subjects, as I know you've been enjoying it along with me. We are going to give you, in about 5 minutes, the opportunity to call us. The number is 430-2700, 430-2700, and you're very intelligent questions, greatly appreciated, and we will entertain your questions. However, I want to go to what there was one other point, Imam Muhammad. That, is it true that Sister Clara Muhammad brought Elijah Poole to the mystic teacher, that is the founder of the Nation of Islam? Was she the one
that
brought him to the first meeting? And
that is true.
Yes.
Yes. My mother told me in the presence of my father it was just in the last, she wasn't making this the point of her conversation. The conversation was on this mystic, this mysterious man
mm-hmm.
Called Farad, W.F. Farad, W.D. Farad, Farad Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
He said that, I remember when I went to hear him, he said, a friend of mine told me that there was a man
mm-hmm.
that was teaching a strange teaching about black people being brought from the East and having another religion before they came to America, before they were brought to America. She said, so he decided to go to hear this man speak.
Mm-hmm.
And he was speaking in a home, of one of the African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was a house now, an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the picture I got from what she was saying. And she said that they held meetings in the home, and he was speaking. And she said she was very impressed with what he was saying. So she went back, and she knew that her husband needed a lot of help.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about that that the black man wasn't a drunkard, and he wasn't drinking, and
mm-hmm.
he wasn't a pork eater when he was in Africa as a Muslim or in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
He said Asia.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, he didn't say Africa. He said Asia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess he thought Africa would turn him off, I guess,
mm-hmm.
back then. And it would have.
Yeah,
many of them would have been turned off.
Black man.
Yeah, so he called, yeah, he said Asiatic black man.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and when you were there, you didn't eat pork and you didn't drink. So my mother said she knew her husband needed a lot of help.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of help. So mm-hmm. she wanted him to go. Now, she didn't join.
Mm-hmm.
My mother didn't join. She went and told my father about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next time, my father went and told her to come along with him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So she came along with him.
Mm-hmm.
He said after he heard the meeting, he joined.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the talk, he would give an opportunity if anybody wanted to join, they would join. He joined. He came back that same night and told her, now they poor now,
yeah.
poor,
mm-hmm.
poor. Mm-hmm. Told her, take all the pork out of the refrigerator
mm-hmm.
and throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
she said she was didn't she said off her bath. He said she didn't wasn't gonna eat the pork. She said, but she didn't feel good throwing it away.
Mm-hmm.
She said, so she, without his knowledge, she had a hungry girlfriend. Say she took the pork and gave it to her. She said, and my husband never knew about this until now. She said, she said, I didn't throw that pork away. She said, we would have a too hard a time. She said, I wasn't going to eat it, but I gave it to my friend. Say she gave it to her friend. Yeah. And she said, son, do you know ever since that day, your father haven't eaten pork or drank any liquor?
Mm-hmm. One day he was
one meeting changed his whole
no
life.
No AA and none of all the rest of that.
Now, he wasn't an alcoholic now.
Okay.
But he drank heavily.
Okay, very good. Final question to you before we go to our lines. And the lines will be 430-2700. What was the position of your mother and father on the direction that they knew you were going to take as a result of what they knew about you and your feelings about Alice Sloan?
Well, they've always encouraged me to believe in myself as